Good afternoon. I'm Dr. David Blumenthal, president of the Commonwealth Fund. Thank you for joining us to hear about findings from our new report out tomorrow, looking at trends in employer health insurance costs in every state. I'll provide some brief background and then turn to Sarah Collins, vice president for the Commonwealth Fund's program on healthcare coverage and access, and lead author of the study, for an overview of the report's findings. A reminder, the information discussed on this call is embargoed until 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, November 21st. This new report provides a state-by-state look at the cost of health care for the vast majority of people under age 65 in the United States, 164 million, who get their health care insurance through an employer. This report is unique in its state-by-state perspective, measuring how much insurance is costing workers in premiums, deductibles, and as a share of their income from 2008 to 2018. The analysis shows wide variation across the 50 states in the burden that healthcare costs impose on working-age Americans with employer-sponsored insurance. It shows that over the last decade, premiums and deductibles have taken up a larger share of families' income across the country. As the 2020 campaign season progresses, it's clear that healthcare is a top concern for American families, and rightfully so. Healthcare and health insurance coverage are essential to people's well-being and financial security, and yet employer healthcare coverage is leaving millions of families exposed to high and potentially unaffordable costs. Ensuring that everyone can afford their health care will require policy fixes and system-wide efforts to get to the heart of the health care cost problem, the exorbitant prices we often pay for health care in the United States. As Sarah will detail shortly, there are several policy fixes that have the potential to reduce healthcare burdens for workers and families struggling to afford healthcare they need, while also making our health system work better for everyone. I'll turn to Sarah Collins now for the report findings.
Thank you, David. I want to recognize my co-authors, David Radley, who is on the call, and Jesse Baumgartner. The analysis in the report we are releasing tomorrow is based on the latest data from the insurance component of the Federal Medicare Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. The MEPS-IC is the most comprehensive national survey of U.S. employer health plans. It surveyed more than 40,000 business establishments in 2018 with an overall response rate of 67%. The purpose of this study was to look at trends over the last decade in the amount that Americans pay for their employer health insurance and the size of their deductibles in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. The study examines the amount of income these costs represent for middle-income families. To smooth year-to-year fluctuations, we examine two-year moving averages across the decade. Please go to Exhibit 1, where I provide an overview of the study findings. The reason we wanted to look at people's insurance costs relative to income is that research indicates that these costs have consequences. People with low and moderate incomes may go without insurance if it competes with other expenses like housing or food, and high deductibles may lead people to skip needed health care or not fill prescriptions. What we found is that average annual growth and the combined cost of employees' contributions to premiums and deductibles outpaced growth in U.S. median income between 2008 and 2018 in every state. This means that premium contributions and deductibles in employer plans took up a growing share of people's incomes over that time period. Those costs together accounted for 11.5% of median household income by 2018, up from 7.8% a decade earlier. Exhibit 2. I'm first going to discuss trends in these aggregate measures of premiums and deductibles. After that, I'll break them down into their component parts. Between 2008 and 2018, employee premium contributions across single and family plans in the light blue line on the chart grew faster than U.S. median income, which is in the orange line. Deductibles are the amount of health care services people have to pay for out-of-pocket before their insurance coverage kicks in. Over the last decade, the size of deductibles, the dark blue line, also grew faster than median income. While the gap between growth in median income and growth in premiums and deductibles has narrowed in the most recent two-year period, these costs continue to climb more rapidly than income. Exhibit 3. To see how much income middle-income families might have to allocate on average to their health insurance premiums and deductibles, we looked at the ratio of employee premium contributions and deductibles to median income. The average employee cost across single and family plans, the light blue line, amounted to nearly 7% of median income in 2018, up from 5.1% in 2008. Deductibles, which are in the orange line, also averaged across single and family plans, amounted to 4.7% of median income, up from 2.7% in 2008. Added together, the total cost of premiums and deductibles, which is the top line on the chart, was 11.5% of median income in 2018. This is up from 7.8% a decade earlier. Exhibit 4. Premiums and deductibles, as well as median income, vary considerably across the country. The darker shaded states in these three maps are states in which workers face the highest premiums and deductibles as a share of their income. By 2018, premiums and deductibles were 12% or more of median income in 17 states, the dark blue states on the map. These are states where median income is below the national average, and most are in the South. In Louisiana and Mississippi, these combined costs were 16% or more of median income. Exhibit 5. I'm going to shift now to a discussion of trends in these costs broken down into their component parts, premiums, and then deductibles. First, with respect to premiums, the total premium in employer plans, including contributions from both employers and employees, rose at a faster pace between 2016 and 2018 than it did in the prior two-year period between 2014 and 2016. Premiums in single plans grew at an average annual rate of 4.9%. Family plan premiums grew at 5.1% annually. Exhibit 6. For single-person plans, U.S. workers are contributing about 21% of the cost of the total plan premium on average. This share has not changed much over time. In 2018, the premium amount that workers contributed for single-person plans ranged from a low of $755 in Hawaii to a high of about $1,900 in Massachusetts. Exhibit 7. For family plans, workers contribute about 28% of the total premium cost on average. This also has not changed much over time. But in five states, this share was as high as one-third of the total cost. Worker contributions to family plans ranged from a low of nearly $3,900 in Washington to a high of nearly $6,600 in Virginia. Exhibit 8. This map shows worker premium contributions averaged across single and family plans as a share of median income in each state. In nine states, the deep turquoise states on the map, premium contributions were 8% or more of median income, with a high of 10% in Louisiana. Exhibit 9. In many states, even though premium costs take up a large share of people's incomes, many people are not getting insurance that offers them good cost protection. This is because, for many, deductibles are also high. Over the decade, deductibles grew both in proliferation and size. About 87% of employer plans had deductibles in 2018. This is up from 71% in 2008. In 2018, deductibles ranged in size from a low of $1,300 in the District of Columbia and Hawaii to a high of more than $2,400 in Maine. Exhibit 10. Research has indicated that high deductibles can act as a financial barrier to care, discouraging people with modest incomes from getting needed services and leaving them effectively underinsured. In our studies of underinsurance, the Commonwealth Fund has defined people as underinsured if their plan deductible is equal to 5% or more of income. This map shows that per-person deductibles averaged over single and family plans amounted to 5% or more of median income in 18 states, the deep turquoise states on the map, indicating that many people in employer plans are effectively underinsured. Average deductibles ranged as high as 6.7% of income in Mississippi. Exhibit 11. Just to recap the major findings of the report, Over the last decade, U.S. median income has not kept pace with families' premium costs in employer health plans. At the same time, deductibles in these plans have also grown faster than income, leaving many families underinsured. People across the country are not experiencing employer health insurance costs equally. The most cost-burdened families live in southern states. Democratic presidential candidates have proposed a range of options to improve insurance affordability and lower healthcare costs, which are the key driver of premiums. Some proposals would build on the Affordable Care Act and provide people in employer plans with an option to enroll in a public plan like Medicare. Others propose to replace the Affordable Care Act and all private insurance, including employer coverage, with a public plan like Medicare and eliminate all premiums and cost sharing. Republican reform ideas are less well developed at this point, but tend to favor replacing the Affordable Care Act with market-oriented approaches and more state control over insurance markets and the Medicaid program. We are certain to hear more from candidates and likely voters on healthcare affordability issues in the coming year. And I'll stop there and hand this back over to David and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll take questions now, and Sarah's co-author is also here to answer your questions, David Radley, Senior Scientist in the Commonwealth Fund's Tracking Health System Performance Program.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press the star, then one keys on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, star one to ask a question today. And we'll take our first question of the day from Susanna Lucy with Politico. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this study and this call. Just wondering if you saw much difference between in your findings between the small and the large group employer insurance, if there is any significant premium difference.
You know, we actually did not look at differences in the small. We just limited to the whole group. We didn't break out differences.
Okay. And do you do much talking to employers for this study of whether they're seeing, much pushback from employees as the deductibles rise?
Yeah, we used a federal database. So it's a federal survey of employers. We actually did not do the interviewing.
Okay.
This is David Blumenthal. I would say, and it's not direct information, that the current concern with the affordability of healthcare has a lot to do with employer deductibles and employer-sponsored insurance and premiums and deductibles. So I think if you look to the origins of healthcare's salience as a issue at the current time, the trends that this report cites are likely to be an important factor.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll move next to Ben Connark with the Miami Herald. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thanks for holding this call. I actually have a couple questions, but I wanted to start with, do we have any reason to think that these cost increases are leading to a rise in the number of uninsured people? In other words, are people faced with high premiums and deductibles opting to go uninsured as opposed to using their employee-provided health insurance?
It's a really good question, and we haven't seen much change in employer enrollment over time, so it's remained pretty stable. There is one factor that might change that, of course, is the withdrawal of the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act, which means that not everybody you no longer face a tax penalty if you don't have coverage. But I think there is some real concern when you look at some of these numbers, particularly in states where the premiums start to rise as a share of median income, and you think about the income distribution that people kind of in the mid-range, about $64,000 a year, are paying quite a bit of their income in some states across the country. And so if you think about people who are just below that level, whose income, whose premiums are even a larger share of their income. And the question is, if people are facing premium costs that high, at which point do they decide not to continue having insurance or electing insurance in plans? And what point does it become a matter of public policy to think about addressing that affordability issue? So the Affordable Care Act obviously caps what people spend as a share of their income that extends to employer plans. But many people get caught in this family coverage glitch and they're in unaffordable plans because their family premiums are high. So I think it is a concern and looking forward. The Congressional Budget Office does estimate that some people in employer-based plans, because of the loss of the mandate penalty, will actually drop coverage. And when you add the rising premium contributions, the flat growth in income that we're seeing, it does become a concern over time.
Thank you. Just one second. So the other question I had is just actually you set it up pretty well. It does have to do with the Affordable Care Act and also, you know, the timeline here in these trends that we're seeing. I mean, could you talk a little bit more about what you think might be driving these increases and how does that timeline match up with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act?
For a few years, right after the Affordable Care Act, there was a flattening in growth in employer premiums. So if you look at that, if you look at the exhibit, and I'll point to exhibit 5 in the chart pack. You can see kind of a drop off in growth in employer premiums after 2010, and it's upticked recently between 2016 and 2018. So the premium growth actually slowed a bit after the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in employer plans.
Thank you. That's all my questions.
Thank you. And we'll move next to Sarah Gantz with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you guys for doing this call. I was hoping you could speak a little bit more to what you see as the potential ways that the cost of insurance will influence how people use their plans, the type of care they get.
That's a really good question. You know, the research that Commonwealth Fund has done on high deductibles and people with high out-of-pocket costs has shown that as your deductibles increase, you're less likely to get needed health care. You're less likely to fill prescriptions that you need. You're less likely to go to the doctor when you're sick. So these do act as a financial barrier to care. People on average tend not to use very much health care, but the fact of the deductible, the fact that many people, particularly in the mid-range of the income distribution, don't have that much savings, does act as a disincentive to get needed health care.
So I wanted just to inject a personal story, which I think is okay to tell because the person involved has told it publicly. A physician by the name of Ashish Jha, who is a very well-known health services researcher, professor at Harvard, and also an active physician, decided to enroll in a high-deductible health plan through his Harvard insurance to get an idea of what it was like to have that kind of a policy. And he tells the story of waking up in the middle of the night with heart palpitations. He actually had an abnormal rhythm called atrial fibrillation. And he said that as a physician, he knew he should go to the hospital, but because he has had such a high deductible, he decided not to. And I think that that's an interesting indicator of how, at the point of decision, even well-informed people may change their behavior because of the cost of the care they face.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And we'll go next to Jack O'Brien with Health Leaders Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my question. I'm really curious about what's the most pressing takeaway for hospital executives. They comprise most of our readership, and I'm curious what these trends mean for the bottom line of their organization.
This is David Blumenthal. That's a complicated question, and I think on the whole, it will probably be unfortunate for hospital finances because it will discourage utilization, and it will add to bad debt. Because when people with high deductibles use their health care, they go home with unpaid bills, and those bills have to be collected, and often they can't be afforded by the individuals who incur them. So though the Affordable Care Act reduced uncompensated care for hospitals generally, this trend threatens to at least in part reverse that the relief that the Affordable Care Act provided.
And I'll add just to a survey data point in a survey that the Commonwealth Fund ran about a year or two ago. We asked people if they were to get a surprise bill, so if they were to maybe go to the emergency room or have an unexpected bill of $1,000, would they have the money to pay it off in 1 month? And about a third of people in employer-based plans said no to that question, and about half of people, as you go down the income scale, half of people with lower income said no. So people may avoid care, but at some point it becomes inevitable. You have the inevitable emergency room visit, and people just tend not to have the assets to cover an unexpected cost like that.
Yeah, just to add another perspective on this, we've seen over the last half decade or decade falling utilization for inpatient services, and that is a problem for hospitals, especially hospitals that have excess capacity. The response seems to have been, looking at national trends, to raise prices. And in raising prices, hospitals create at least a public relations vulnerability for themselves that they are now struggling with. So I think deductibles have an indirect effect on hospital finances that can involve can create a backlash from, and I think as you see the pressure for price transparency, that has its origin, at least in part, in the perception that prices are very high.
I just want to make a quick point. I know there are other people on that. There's a loop there. I mean, just to close the loop, we know that the primary driver of healthcare costs right now are prices in commercial-based plans, provider prices in commercial-based plans. So the extent that hospital prices are rising, that feeds into, that drives premium costs, it drives deductible costs. So people are facing higher deductibles that reduces their incentive to get care from the very providers that are on average the source of the growth in their insurance costs.
Excellent. Thank you for your answers.
Thank you. And we'll go next to Randy Crable with Tulsa World. Please go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering if you have any explanations for the state-to-state variations in the costs.
That's a great question, and I guess it's good to keep in mind all the different components of what we're measuring. So there is the overall premium that employers and employees pay for. There is the part that employees pay for, the share that they're mm-hmm. that they're required to pay. There is the deductible that they face, and critically there is their median income. So. Mm-hmm. So in states that just generally have lower median income, even if their premium mm-hmm. costs or premium contributions might be a little lower than average, they might mm-hmm. they may have a much larger burden than people in a state with higher median incomes and in even higher premium costs.
So the actual dollar costs, on some of the charts they vary quite a bit, but did you look at all? Were you able to see any correlations between states that have expanded Medicaid and those that have not?
That's a good question. We didn't actually just break it down. We're just presenting a straightforward set of data to look at, but it's an important question because for people in expansion states who are in employer-based plans where their costs are high, everyone below 138% of poverty is actually eligible for Medicaid, so people can enroll in that. So that helps people in that lower end of the income distribution. For states that haven't expanded Medicaid, obviously, people don't have that ability to shift into Medicaid. But they also might be eligible for a marketplace subsidy if their costs are unaffordable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. One other thing. Copays, are they included in the deductibles?
We don't analyze copay separately, so this is just deductible size and premium contribution.
Okay.
Just to add another generalization to thinking about this cost burden issue, the most difficult state or location for an employee and their family would be a state where wages are low and employers don't feel pressure or are not inclined to be generous in their sharing of healthcare costs. So there's the nature of the workers is a very important factor in this equation, and of course healthcare costs, but I'd say that you don't want to be in a low-wage environment where there's an abundance of workers.
All right. Thank you. thank you.
Thank you. And we'll move next to Sarah Hansard with Bloomberg Law. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Sarah did mention that the primary driver of costs in employer plans is provider fees. As I'm sure you're aware, employers have been complaining for some time now that their costs have been going up well beyond inflation. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, as well as the issue of high deductibles in ACA plans. The point that the administration makes a lot is that there's been a big increase. And in fact, I think it's the biggest part of the increase in the uninsured is from people who are over 300% of the poverty limit, which seems to indicate that if you don't get subsidies or if you don't get much in the way of subsidies and you're in the individual market, you know, that's a factor. But just on the employer side, any thoughts on the ACA deductible issue as well as employer costs?
So on the topic of employer costs, employers are indeed in a real bind. The per capita costs that have been incurred by Medicare and Medicaid have been pretty stable since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, but per capita costs for employees have been going up. Utilization has been stable. The cause of the increased cost has been increasing prices. Employers have not found a way, working with insurers, to negotiate lower prices from the hospitals and doctors who supply services. There are a lot of reasons for that, and I don't know if you want to go into them all, but that's the core issue on the employer side with respect to increasing costs. They have, as a solution, transferred more costs onto their employees. There is a pretty widespread opinion right now that approach to managing the costs of the health care benefits they provide has run its course, and that continuing to shift those costs onto employees is no longer feasible, that they're getting to the point where employees can't bear more of the cost. So that's going to vary from place to place, as our data suggests, but speaking generally across the nation. So they have a real dilemma right now, they are going to have to come up with some innovative solutions. I think that's why you see the example of the alliance between Amazon, the Warren Buffett's organization, and J.P. Morgan, Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan. It's in search of innovative ways to manage those prices. So that's the issue of cost and price. Sarah can.
And just on the deductible issue, you raised a very good point. The Affordable Care Act subsidies have been effective in lowering deductibles for people under 250% of poverty, which is about $30,000 for an individual, $60,000-ish for a family of four. But when you go above that, there are no cost-sharing subsidies, and so people are facing pretty high deductibles often in those plans. That is a increasingly shared issue among people in employer-based plans, as these data point out. And so I think that just in terms of a policy solution, and what we're seeing really among Democratic proposals at this point in the campaign, extending those subsidies, so both on the premium side and the cost sharing side, higher up the income scale. But I think critically, also removing the employer-based insurance so-called firewall, so allowing people through this public option that's been discussed in employer plans, the ability to take advantage of those subsidies, the ability to buy in the individual market. So I think that does kind of collectively address some of the affordability issues we're seeing in the individual market, and then also in employer-based plans for a lot of people that have kind of middle incomes and are facing pretty high deductibles and premium costs.
Okay. Could I add one more question? The other question would be, that might take care of, you know, those people, but it doesn't take care of the underlying healthcare cost issue. Like I think David was talking about the hospitals, you know, when they have more beds, they just raise their costs. They don't seem to have figured out a way to get costs down. I mean, that raises the amount of money that taxpayers have to spend on subsidies, but what about getting healthcare costs down?
Right. I think it's probably a paired challenge. I think policymakers do need to address the affordability issues people are facing, particularly since it does seem to be affecting people's ability to get their health care. But I think the cost issue is critically important. It is the major driver of these trends that we're seeing really in both markets.
Okay, thanks a lot.
If I could just add some perspective on this issue, the reason for the recent rules on price transparency is to get at precisely this question. So there are two theoretical approaches to dealing with prices. One is to enhance competition, and the other is to regulate prices. Maryland is still the only state that still regulates healthcare prices. The administration is promoting a strategy of competition, betting that if you make prices visible and knowable, that people will shop for lower prices. That remains to be seen because employers have never been effective at exerting market power to negotiate down prices.
Okay.
And right now, providers are very consolidated and have a lot of market power. Employers are very fragmented and have very little market power.
Okay.
So knowing prices will not be sufficient, in my view, in and of itself, to give them the power to negotiate prices down.
Okay, thank you.
And I think we're also seeing in states like Washington who are attempting to add a public option into the marketplaces, so an effort to go to a more regulated approach or a reference pricing approach, so setting prices in those networks closer to Medicare rates or some percentage of Medicare rates.
Yeah. That starts in 2021. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll go next to Yen Duong with North Carolina Health News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I know you've already addressed the Medicaid expansion question, but why are things just seem worse in the South? For instance, you know, this high level of 11% seen nationally, North Carolina, we were at that in 2008, and now we're just getting worse. So what's special about the South that's causing these trends?
So just looking at North Carolina as an example, North Carolina has a median income that's below the national average, which is one of the drivers of the larger burden in that state. Premiums overall in North Carolina are actually below the national average, so both single and family coverage. But contributions, what people are paying for those premiums, employees are spending on those premiums are somewhat above the national average. And then the same is true for deductibles. So deductibles in North Carolina are higher than the national average. And when you combine that with a relatively lower median income, you end up with a much bigger cost burden relative to states like Massachusetts that have higher incomes and actually somewhat lower premium contributions. So it's median income is a big part of the story, but as David mentioned earlier, it's also what employers are asking their employees to contribute in these states. And obviously, this is a state average too. So it's not the same in every region of North Carolina and every county, but on average, this is this seems to be the flavor that we're seeing.
Of like another state that has below national average median income, but still has a pretty decent percentage that people are paying for their healthcare costs.
Mississippi, I believe, is one that we highlighted at the end of the report. Is another state with a similar set of higher premium contributions, somewhat higher deductibles, but also one of the lowest median incomes in the country. You know, I guess too, if you look at, I mean, you'll look at it more carefully when you're doing your analysis. But the what people are spending, what people are required to contribute, particularly in family plans, in five states, it was more than a third of the overall cost. And most of those states are actually in the South. So there, it's a combination of what people are asked to contribute to their plans, and the lower than the national average median income.
Thank you very much.
I'm from Massachusetts, and as I look at where Massachusetts stands on this, Massachusetts has some of the highest costs in the country, maybe the highest costs for healthcare in the country. But it also has very high incomes because of the quality of the jobs there, the fact that it's there's a big biotech, a big high-tech component to the employment. So it's a very competitive labor market. And the result is so employers have to offer generous benefits in order to attract workers. And the result is that high costs do not translate into a high share of worker burden. They may absolutely pay more, but the burden as a percent of income is less.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move next to Laura Garcia with San Antonio Express News. Please go ahead.
Hi. So I'm interested in the median. So for somewhere like Texas, you're going to be using the state median, which I believe is around 60,000. There, like you said, it's not. It's going to be different in different regions. But in San Antonio, for example, our median family income is 49,000. So what does that cost burden look like?
That's a great question. I think it's important to point out, too, I appreciate your question because Texas is a really big state. So this is the average across the state, average across rural areas, average across lower income parts of urban areas. So there are clearly going to be people like in San Antonio who have lower incomes for which these costs are actually going to be, if they're in employer-based plans, are going to be a much larger share of their income.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
But I'd also point out, too, I mean, just the flip side of that, too, is that that the premium costs, the deductible costs, are also a statewide average. So it also may be the case in San Antonio that the premiums will be different from our statewide average. They could be lower. They could be higher. And the same is true with deductibles.
Thank you. And we'll move next to David Ress with Daily Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, I guess this is me. My question was answered earlier. I thought I registered the pound key on that. Thank you, though.
Thank you. We'll move next to Jonathan LaMontia with Crain's New York Business. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. I just had sort of a technical question about the data because it reported on the Commonwealth Fund's brief back in May using the current population survey and kind of gave like a directionally different impression of, so just looking at New York, which is where I cover, you know, it was below the national average in costs, whereas, and it was, you know, combined premium and deductible exposure was something like $2,300, whereas in this report it's up near $6,300, $6,400. So I was wondering if there are certain differences between the medical expenditure panel survey and the one that you based the May report on that might account for that kind of discrepancy.
That's a really good question, and I'll let Dave Radley jump in on that. The current population survey, so that I know that report that you're referring to is a population-based survey. So those are people's reports of what they're paying, both in premiums and deductibles. Whereas these data are reported by employers. So these are premiums reported by employers, and deductibles. So it's a different survey, and you're right, it doesn't always match up. People's reports of what they pay may be different from what their employers are reporting. And again, these are averages, so these are state averages, and the same is true for the current population survey at the state level.
And hi, this is David Radley, and I'll just add that we also looked at something slightly different in the May report, which was actual out-of-pocket spending that individuals faced, like actual dollars that they paid. In this report, we're focusing more on what the deductible is. So effectively, their potential out-of-pocket. You know, if you were to use the entire deductible, this is how much you would have spent. And so, you know, it could be that in New York State, if people have high deductibles and they are feeling like they can't afford to get care, they're actually foregoing care, then they would potentially actually spend less out of pocket, right? And that could account. But you know, if you wanted to, I'll just offer, if you wanted to, you know, follow up offline, I'd probably want to take a look back at our May report just to refresh myself, and we can talk a little bit more about some of the details about that if you'd like.
And Dave highlights a really good point, which is that on average, most people have very low out-of-pocket expenditures every year. It's really concentrated among higher spenders, the amount out-of-pocket costs. So the deductible sits out there, but it doesn't mean that everyone's going to meet that deductible in a given year. But it does act, as we've seen in our survey data, as a disincentive for people to get health care.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll go next to Amy Lotvin with Inside Health Policy. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I actually have a couple, and my first has to do with Exhibit 2, which I'm sort of obsessed with, but I fell off the call for a little while, and I may have missed what you said about it. But I was really wondering if you could explain a little bit about what was going on from 2016 to 2018 that had the drop in the increase in deductibles. And my second question has to do with more recent policies. I'm curious what you guys think about the recent policy that allows HSA-linked high-deductible plans to cover more services pre-deductible. And additionally, in the transparency rule, there are some changes to MLR for, I think, employer and fully insured plans that do value-based insurance design. So I'm curious how those will impact the future of employer-sponsored care or coverage, if you care to speak about that. Thank you.
Right. So just on Exhibit 2, those are average annual rates of growth across a two-year period. So the deductibles themselves aren't falling. It's the rate of growth, their year-to-year growth. So what's really happening, you can see it in the next chart. Deductibles have really not changed that much, and we've seen that in some of the Kaiser survey data too. They kind of have held kind of steady at a relatively high level. So they haven't come down. They just haven't grown as much in the last couple of years. But as a share of people's income, they're still relatively high. So that's just that's a change in the rate of growth across
okay.
those 2 year periods.
But it does indicate that as you said, that this is ending. The pressure's gotten so high that they can't really increase anymore.
Right, I think so, and I think that some anecdotal evidence from employers, employer surveys are indicating that. Are they just at a point where they've gone as high as they can on deductibles? And I think the other thing that they're seeing, and Employee Benefit Research Institute had a great piece out last week, that actually their costs are concentrated in their high spenders, and most people don't really spend that much, so the deductible. Like I said, acts as a disincentive for people to get care, but it's really not where the cost issue is. The cost issue is coming from high spenders, and those pressures are coming really from overall cost trends.
Okay. Excellent. So can segue from that to the new policy about the HSA-linked high deductible plans?
Right. I think that's great, and most employers and also in the individual market too, don't require or exclude certain services pre-deductible. California has actually standardized that in its marketplace plans, but most employers do exclude sets of services from deductibles, like certain kinds of prescription drugs. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act excluded preventive services. There's no cost sharing for those, even if you haven't met your deductible, and this change would enable people who have HSAs to have services excluded. I guess the question is why you wouldn't extend that to everybody who have high deductible plans? Why limit it to just people who actually have a savings account attached to that plan? But it certainly does help people in those plans who are facing high deductibles.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll move next to Andy Davis with the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. Please go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about, I think you mentioned that the reason for the increase in costs recently is due to prices and not utilization. So what are some of the reasons for the increase in prices? And is that what relationship, if any, does the cost have to the increase in coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the biggest source of increased cost in our healthcare system right now seems to be the increasing prices that are charged by providers of care to commercial insurers and that are passed on to employers. Prices and utilization in the Medicare program have been stable, relatively speaking, And that's also true in the Medicaid program. And that, together, those account for most of the people in the United States who have coverage. And so why are prices going up? Well, there are undoubtedly multiple explanations. The first is probably because they can. And if you are running a business, let's not call it a healthcare business, let's call it some other kind of business, and your volumes of sales are declining, you can lower prices and try to increase volume, or you can increase prices and stay if you can't influence the volume. It's very hard to increase prices when your volumes are falling in most businesses, but in healthcare it's possible. That is a true peculiarity of the healthcare market. It's a conundrum, and it reflects, as I said before, the disorganization of the purchasers, what economists would call the inelasticity of demand, the fact that demand for healthcare is not price sensitive for many services. And there you have to keep in mind that 50% of spending is attributed to 5% of the population, and that's a 5% of the population that has multiple chronic conditions, often complicated by behavioral health issues. So that 50% is not very elastic in its use of healthcare services. They are sick and they need care. Those are again peculiarities of the healthcare market. The fact also is that even the biggest employers that you can imagine, think Walmart, think Amazon, the really big U.S. Employers have very few markets where they have more than a very small fraction of the population. Amazon may dominate Seattle, but it doesn't dominate anywhere else, and the same would be true of Walmart. They may dominate in certain parts of Arkansas, but they don't dominate anywhere else. So when they go to the local hospital and say, give us a better price, the local hospital says, no thanks, because they can live without that segment of the population. And if that's true for Walmart, it's true for everybody. So that's the nature of healthcare markets. There's very little restraint on pricing. To add that to the fact that our studies show that 70% of hospital markets in the United States are highly concentrated, meaning that there's no competition. So people like the Walmarts of the world can't say to the hospital that refuses to lower prices, well, that's okay, we'll go to the hospital down the street. There is no hospital down the street. That is the nature of our healthcare market right now.
I guess I still don't understand why the cost, you know, had been slowing down and then increased all of a sudden.
It's not costs that are increasing, it's prices.
Well, right. But why did that happen with prices? Like, why did they all of a sudden start increasing more?
I think it has something to do with the fact that volumes have been falling, so that you have to maintain your revenue. You have to make more per unit of service than you did before in order to maintain your bottom line.
And I guess, too, I mean, then this is not new. I think there's been a lot of research that has shown that prices, when you just compare to other countries, prices are a lot higher in the United States than they are in other countries. So it's always been a feature of our health system, and it's particularly has become increasingly visible, as David said, as utilization has gone down, that costs are continuing to decline, but it's really driven by prices.
Thank you. And we have no further questions in queue at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much for your attention and for the questions, and thanks for listening. If you need additional information, we will be available this afternoon. And just to remind you, the embargo for this report lifts at 12:01 a.m. tomorrow.